You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another installment of the Orthodox Nationalist, a weekly web-based lecture series on all things Orthodox Nationalist, and especially Russian and Ukrainian. Today is the 10th of March, 2024. And like I always do, although it gives me no pleasure to do this, I will remind you that I require donations and subscriptions and etc. to function. And, you know, I don't enjoy saying this every time, but it's something that has to be done so I could remain full-time. This is extremely important. There's one thing that I am, for better or for worse, and that is unique. No one is putting out the information I am and making the predictions that seemingly always come true, like me. Whether it be Patreon, that blue box on the website that says the Orthodox Medievalist, that's me. Anything you can do is extremely helpful. There's a book called The German Revolt Against the West, which is actually written in the Third Reich. I had Dr. Heinke. It's been translated. I'm not sure if it's out yet. But especially the first half of the book interested me greatly. It seems odd to have a book that's titled The Revolt Against the West, or The German Revolt Against the West. It's the heart of the West, right? Well, it just depends on how you define it. I think by West, they're talking about the egocentric, mercantile, merchant republics of Britain and the Netherlands and Portugal. And I think the revolt has to do with the fact that Germany is a land power, as is Russia. Now, of course, you could have Western land powers, but that's not who became dominant in Western Europe. We'll talk about that book a little bit, as well as many others, including a book that hasn't been released yet, but I have a rough draft of, from Mikhail Nazarov, the head of the Union of the Russian People in Russia right now. And it's on this topic, the interplay of Moscow, the German state, the Middle Ages, the Holy Roman Empire, Byzantium, and Old Rome, as a really the completion of the religious history of Europe up until the Reformation. And of course, these empires all were at war with the Reformation. Germany, especially, although the German church was an independent one. And of course, I argue from the Russian point of view, which is not well attested in academia or anywhere else, reading academic topics or papers on this topic is just extremely painful. But I probably don't have to tell you that there's no exaggerating the significance of Rome. Rome is an idea. Of course, the idea of a certain kind of imperium in European and even, you know, Middle Eastern history. I don't care where you go. You know, Greek was a dominant language in the Middle East for a long time. So you can't exaggerate the fundamental importance for civilization. As far as we're concerned, it is civilization. But that's a complicated topic. Europe is divided in two, and I think will always will be. And Germany seems to be in the middle. And I find it very interesting to compare the Holy Empire as it developed in Germany and as it developed in the successor state to Byzantium in Moscow. Now, there's quite a bit of differences, but Germany is one of these bridge societies, and the revolt and Hunk is talking about, concerns the rejection of the Holy Empire, of what came to typify the mercantile domination of the British. The concept of the empire and Orthodox theology is extremely complicated. No matter what I say, it's going to be an oversimplification. At the most fundamental, church fathers, St. Paul, saw the empire as a physical restraint against evil. Once we were expelled from the garden, evil grew. It was introduced not just into our minds, but also not just the noumenal world, but the phenomenal world too. But God, of course, could have abandoned us. He did not. But as proof that he doesn't abandon us, he created an external structure. An organization of human community was necessary against evil, starting for the patriarchal clan, and clans combining to form a tribe, and then from there, an ethnic group, and quite possibly an empire. And even that's, there's nothing simple about any of that. But regardless of where you are, and I'm not even saying one doesn't necessarily follow another, I reject that concept of history. There is no causality there. It depends very much on circumstances. But at all stages, it was autocracy that continued to emerge as the most effective, the royalist, the monarchical principle, saturated with ethnic tradition, curbing the forces of chaos, confusion that come from self-will. It regulates the broader division of labor, and very importantly, enforces justice, that is, at an absolute minimum, to fight the arbitrariness that every society has of the strong against the weak. But when we use the word empire, the European standard is Rome. Now, of course, we call it universal or ecumenical. Obviously, it didn't cover the entire world, despite that being the rhetoric used all the time. It does, however, express a universal principle common to all humanity. And it's the collective defense from evil as a proximate goal, and then the broader goal is for eternal life. As I've said before, Jesus Christ appeared during the height, really, of the Roman Empire and had reached Palestine. I keep reading that somehow Christianity, at its origin, rejected the state. There is not a shred of evidence for that. In fact, I'm not entirely sure where it comes from. The state doesn't play the role that it does in the Old Testament, but it's mentioned quite often. Christ didn't destroy the empire, as many hoped. He did just the opposite, which made him very unpopular. Pretty much everything he did made him unpopular. The opposite. If you want to start a religion, he's the last person you want to use. But he brought it to its final purpose. Now, he directly founded the church, the gate of salvation, as we call it. By the 4th century, rapidly Christianized this colossal empire. Europe, especially the Greek-speaking world, and I'm speaking very generally, was destined to become the engine for the initial spread of the church. The Judaics had abandoned their mission. The Gospel of John says, I came in the name of my Father, you did not receive me, but if another comes in his own name, you will receive him. In chapter 5, they become a people that are preparing for another, someone coming in his own name, and that is Antichrist. And he will outwardly imitate the work of Christ in one form or another. And will also have his own version of the empire, because the two go together. Rome represents the core of civilization in the sense that the meaning of history is connected within it, is found within it, as a confrontation between the forces of Christ and Antichrist. The fathers believed in this restraining power. St. Paul says it right in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, there are a handful of people who make the claim, and this is from Nazarov, that that restraining power after the fall of the empire in 1917 is the Holy Spirit. The problem with that interpretation is that St. Paul says it's going to be taken away. It's going to be withdrawn from the world. Now, it's true that, the divine element in this restraining power is the primary thing, but like everything else, like every sacrament, there's a physical side and there's a spiritual side. There is a noumenal as well as a phenomenal expression. Because we are not pure spirit, we need physical things that encapsulate the spiritual content of whatever we're talking about here. Now, Russia, that is to say Moscow, is in an interesting position because of the struggles of the first Rome, the one in Italy, and the second Rome, very tumultuous, where doctrine and heresy was refuted and clarified, not just in theology, but in politics and in the legal order as well. Russia received all of that as a whole. It didn't have to suffer it, but it can take advantage of it, which means that's a huge advantage. It's a deterrent, and it's a Roman deterrent that has been Russian up until roughly 100 years ago. And this is the whole of European history, especially Germany and Russia. Now, on this series, I've spoken of Justinian, Constantine, Theodosius. I've been through these, and of course, my favorite, Basil II, and the new Rome, the second Rome in Constantinople, founded in 324 on the site of a very small Greek town called Byzantium. Very strategic port city, potentially. Huge building. He took old Rome, which was suffering under every evil you can imagine, and brought it to a more pristine place, closer to the wealth of the East. I mean, the East was always wealthier than the West, and away from the endless barbarian attack. So in 395, though, Theodosius I did divide, as a matter of administrative convenience, the empire into two parts officially. And he put his sons in one or the other. The emperor in the West normally didn't live in the city of Rome, which really became a minor town, in places like mostly Ravenna in the northern part, which again is mostly a Greek area. But they were not considered two separate states. You know, in the West, emperors weren't, you know, like the Holy Roman Emperor was elected by electors, elite electors. And it wasn't really inheritance. There was never any clear conception of succession on any of the iterations of Rome. But it could be military valor, the force of circumstances at the moment, or just a simple coup. Western Rome couldn't stand for long, however. Now, I don't have to go through, you know, starting with the death of Emperor Decius in 251, how Rome was slowly partitioned by the invaders, you know, the Gepids, the Alemanni, everyone from Odoacer to Attila, Genseric. This combination of Roman and German, they call it barbarian, which in and of itself is a very complicated term. There's about 1,000 explanations as to what it means. But in general, it means uncivilized, that is to say, un-Roman, despite the fact that many of them were educated in the Roman way. It didn't take long, especially under Emperor Justinian. Now, I have several lectures of him a few years ago, died in 565, did try to reconquer much of the coastal areas of Italy. And for a short time, it regained its status as a pan-European empire for the most part. Needless to say, of course, we all know what happened to Byzantium, about 800 years later. But whether we're talking about German history, or Byzantine Russian history, Rome played a gigantic role in their life. And in fact, you talk about Russia and Germany. The title of the German Empire initially, beginning in the 16th century, I shouldn't say initially. For the German, it was the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, which is an extremely interesting way to put it. We'll talk about that in a minute. And of course, the Russian version was Moscow, the Third Rome. Now, while these two conceptions differ from each other, it helped create two, what in my opinion, are similar nations, the Russian on the one hand and the German on the other. New Rome, Constantinople, did the bulk of the work in the ecumenical councils. They had to be convened by the emperor. The Pope eventually taking the dignity of the emperor, claimed to be able to call them of his own authority. But that struggle in the first millennium, one of the most interesting and productive intellectual vortices that anyone can imagine, from 325 to 787. And it wasn't just a matter of theology or behavior or morals, it was also the nature of the state. Now, one of my big arguments, just an absolute core understanding, fundamental understanding that I have about the world, that it was a Council of Chalcedon that not only gave the final word as to who Christ is or what Christ is, but how the church and the state, to speak very generally, cooperate. It's no accident that every time a heresy came out, the emperors all ran to it. The one thing that all the heresies have in common is that they upset the balance between the human and the divine. And no matter which way the imbalance goes, the state wins. So, Chalcedon used the metaphysics of Plato, scriptures, the tradition up until that point, the Old Testament, to give the final word of the two natures unified in one human being, like church and state in one nation. Each nature had its own will, but they cooperate. And in Christ's sense, they couldn't help but cooperate. From that comes the nature of political, religious, and legal authority. So it's the balance of, on the one hand, the earthly and the heavenly natures on the other. And that's where the concept of the symphony of royal and spiritual authorities come together. I don't have to tell you, of course, that the Reformation completely destroyed this, and nothing was ever the same again. The empire under Justinian was enormous. And one of the major triumphs was the collection of Roman laws. 50 volumes, the Corpus Iuris Civilis, and it became the foundation of European law. And certainly, not just up to the Reformation, but in much of the world afterward. Construction, not only churches, but monuments, and building this identity. Because of the walls, the Theodosian walls, the barbarian attacks didn't have the effect that they did elsewhere. You had some of the pagan Slavs at the time. Justinian helped build the very powerful defensive line on the banks of the Danube. The concept, though, from Justinian onward, is to embody this Christian idea on earth. One ruling God, that law that he exudes, one church that is one grace-filled reality, doctrine, and manifest by the one great ruler on earth. Now that opens up numerous cans of worms. While that's exceptionally simple, that's the line. Justinian helped develop, for lack of a better phrase, the Orthodox theory of the state. The Chalcedonian formula. For the first time, this was the attempt to balance these two in actual functioning day-to-day society. And he claimed he came as close as he could in an extremely tumultuous time to bring that about. Of course, Chalcedon took place in the 5th century, the middle of the 5th century. And it had been, for the most part, the understanding of the Christian world. But because of the attacks on it, the Monophysites and Nestorians, it had to be explicated in tremendous detail. And it was all done in Greek, by the way. This wasn't a cultural matter, like some people think. But in the West, it was a different story, though. Germany was the principle of revival in Western Europe. And it was a completely different place than once the mercantile cities began to dominate. The Roman Church gathered Western Europe into a single whole, becoming the single political authority, at least on paper, and that in that process drifted away from the ancient church. The Germans were essential to everything Roman in the West, starting with the Frankish Empire, replacing the Merovingian dynasty ruling at the end of the 5th century, overthrown by the majordomo Pepin the Short, proclaimed himself king in 751, sending the last Merovingian king, Childeric III, to a monastery. And in the process, built an alliance with the Pope of Rome, Pope Zechariah, at the time. Stephen II, 754, who was the pope after him, anointed Pepin as king of the Franks and commanded the aristocracy to elect kings for themselves only from this dynasty. And Pepin then took a solemn oath to defend the interests of the Roman church body. And that's, as a result, he gave the papacy the papal states, this chunk of land in the dead center of Italy. Now, Pope Hadrian was loyal to Constantinople, but in 800, Pope Leo III crowned the son of Pepin the Short, that is, Charlemagne, since 768, the emperor of the Romans, in Rome itself. So there you have the official fusing of the crown on the one hand, the empire on the one hand, the church on the other. However, the imbalance was that the Roman Church, especially over the next few centuries, claimed absolute dominion over everything, not just in religion. Now, it is mentioned that in 812, the Roman Emperor Michael I in Byzantium did recognize this Roman title in among the Franks, but he was at war with Bulgaria and needed Western help. I mean, Bulgaria had defeated the Roman army in 811. Michael began to panic, and because he was recognized then, Charles ceded the protectorate of Ravenna and Dalmatia to Constantinople. But that didn't last. It was clearly a matter of practical convenience. Now, in the West, because of how strangely this developed, you didn't have two. You know, the so-called two swords theory of Glacius. Forgeries played a role. The donation of Constantine, which I think most of you have heard of, which became a part of the decretals of the pseudo-Isidore. And that was to justify Roman claims to be the successor of the first Rome, Rome itself. And the claim is that Constantine the Great gifted his imperial powers to the Bishop of Rome as he moved the capital to the east. And that became part of the decretals of Pseudo-Isidore, claiming it from the great Saint Isidore, and it is not. but from the middle of the 11th century on, these served as the main grounds for papal claims. Church and state in medieval Europe. These are Carolingian creations. The decretals contain decrees of church synods, local and ecumenical, about 100 papal epistles. Most of them are forged, but there's also legitimate things in there, so it gets very confusing, especially at the time. And it gained tremendous popularity. And I mentioned, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, that Nikon of Moscow, Patriarch Nikon, used these false decretals to justify his power, despite the lack of acceptance of this, for the most part, in the East at the time. Charlemagne's empire didn't really outlast him, middle of the 9th century. The last Western emperor, Berengar of Friuli, died in 924, and for a while there was an interregnum by the empire's most powerful aristocratic families. And yet again, the source of the new revival was also Germany, because the Treaty of Verdun affected the grandchildren of Charlemagne, 843, and it divided Western Europe into three major parts: the West Frankish Kingdom, which went to Charles the Bald, the Kingdom of Lorraine in the middle, Lothair, and the Germany proper, where it went to Louis the German. And he, in 870, conquered the Middle Kingdom of Lorraine, which had the most tentative position. The East Frankish Kingdom, soon to be one day the Holy Roman Empire, united the lands of pretty much all German speakers, including some of the very West Slavic lands. And during the 10th century, the kind of informal name was the Teutonic Reich. You had then the problem of two emperors. And this has been a huge source of controversy, not just at the time, but among scholars today. I mentioned the simple thesis that there is one God, there is one law, there is one church, there is one truth, therefore, there is one empire, one authority. Therefore, having two emperors is a bit of a problem. The Emperor Louis II, in the Carolingian period, this is in 871, he wrote a letter. Louis was the fourth emperor of the Carolingian Empire, but he didn't have much of a domain, because it had been fractured by that point, as I just mentioned. And we're talking about the Emperor Basil I of Byzantium. Basil's letter is lost. But the two empires were cooperating against the Muslims, but Basil had refused to recognize Louis as a Roman emperor. The title of Roman, according to Basil, was not hereditary. Still considered really a Republican office for the most part. It wasn't considered proper of someone of an ethnic group. Now, we're going to get into the concept of ethnicity here. The Gens or the Gentes. That's an ethnic group. Now, there's the idea that Franks and others really throughout Europe were seen as different Gentes. But Basil didn't see it that way. Roman, and this will be challenged later, was not seen by him as an ethnic marker. In fact, they were defined by their lack of ethnic membership. So Louis was not Roman and therefore couldn't be Roman emperor. There was only one emperor, and that was Basil himself. He could be emperor of the Franks, emperor of the Germans, emperor of whatever you want, but he is not the emperor of the Romans. The Western idea of ethnicity differed at the time from Byzantium. Everyone belonged to one ethnic group or another. Louis considered the Gens Romana to be the people who actually lived in the city of Rome. And of course, that was replaced by the Byzantine Empire, the New Rome, and the Bosporus. All ethnic groups can be ruled by a Basileus, the supreme emperor in Louis's mind. And the title had been used many times before, including in Persia. That a member of the very fact that you're a member of an ethnic group, which he assumed everyone was a member of something, that was enough to disqualify you from the Roman title. And this is an odd way to argue given the circumstances. And I mention it largely to show how important the ethnic nation was at the time. Various ethnic groups, according to him, the Theodosian dynasty from Spain, the Isaurian dynasty, the Khazars before the conversion, Leo IV, all having provided emperors. Apparently, Byzantines would have seen all of these as Romans and not a member of any ethnic group. And it's very strange. So Basil defends the Roman Empire in ethnic terms, defining it as non-ethnic, despite not considering Roman an ethnicity. And later on, that wasn't the norm. Louis refused to define the empire in ethnic terms, despite considering Rome as a specific ethnic nation, rather than, at the time, some kind of a spiritual aristocracy. In 952, Emperor Constantine VII wrote a very important book, The Administration of the Empire. And he wrote this to his son Romanos II, where he did say that the Byzantines were an ethnic group. So that controversy clearly, that opinion, Byzantium was divided in terms of what ethnicity is. He says, quote, "Never shall an emperor of the Romans ally himself in marriage with a nation whose customs differ from and are alien to those of the Roman order, especially with a nation that is infidel and unbaptized." And that's reasonable in the sense that it's it takes Roman national unity as a cultural entity. He repeats the point again, talking about different laws and institutions. Then he says it is right that each nation should marry and cohabit, not with those of another race and language, but with those of the same tribe and language. He uses phylon for the word race and genos for the word tribe, and we would translate it. And language is central to both. Now, these are very ambiguous terms. He sees racial differences essentially as differences in customs. Byzantines were Romans. They weren't Greeks or Armenians or Persians that had converted. Many ethnic groups disappear because they're absorbed into much larger entities. The point is, in the writings of Caldelis, especially his 2007 book, very important, Byzantium was not a multi-ethnic empire. It was a nation-state of the Romans, which, of course, like every nation, has partially assimilated minorities within its borders. The empire was not fundamentally split into ethnic groups simply because they didn't exist or weren't relevant. There was no ethnic minority challenge. So clearly you have differences of opinion, whether in fact Roman or Byzantine is in fact an ethnic group. I think the consensus in the Byzantine Empire was that it was. But in the polemic with Louis, it was not. As far as Germany goes now, which the very name of the empire had the ethnic marker in it. And I've spoken about the Ottonians before. Otto I, Duke of Saxony, defeated the invading Hungarians in the Battle of the Lech River. And again, those kind of victories give him tremendous authority. He was anointed in Rome as a Roman emperor. He proclaimed formally what we call the Holy Roman Empire today, as a continuation both of the Empire of Charlemagne and Old Rome itself. That alone became a huge problem. The core of it, of course, was German. You also had North Italy, you had the Netherlands, you had pieces of Czechia and even parts of France. But the title of emperor was not hereditary. Unlike the Carolingian era, it was an aristocratic college of electors. And Otto was very concerned with unifying the German-speaking lands. That was his primary priority. So the separation between Germany and France became more or less permanent. Now, Nikephoros Phokas II did not recognize Otto as emperor. Otto was eventually defeated. But after the death of Nikephoros II, Otto arranged the marriage of his son, Otto II, to the Byzantine princess Theophania. After her husband's death, that is to say Otto, she became Holy Roman Empress by marriage and regent of the empire. Now, regardless of whether we're talking Eastern or Western, there is an ethnic root to it all. These weren't multi-ethnic. Now, I can't say that in the Austrian Empire, that was very much, and that was one of its biggest weaknesses. But whether East or West, the point is to manifest as much as humanly possible the earthly embodiment of the kingdom of God, the ruler that maintains peace and tranquility, prosperity in the church and outside of it, and organizes protection from external and internal threats. That's his portfolio. Now, that presupposed interaction between emperor and the papacy. But that's exactly why Otto became the most powerful ruler among all the heirs of Charlemagne. Now, the elections of bishops and abbots, which were the pillar of the Holy Roman Empire in Germany, was carried out from instructions of the emperor, and the church hierarchs took an oath of allegiance to him. It was a pillar, it was an integral part of the empire. The state was relatively weak, but the political nature of these claims to Roman status and the fact that the empire and the papacy began to disagree over these kind of things, and if that were not bad enough, that automatically put them in competition with the established Roman power in the East. So you have two battles going on in this formation. The emperor of the restored Roman Empire, after the coronation of Charlemagne, the popes were always threatened by what they had created, and they saw themselves as simply more of greater authority than the emperor. I mean, after all, he functioned because he was a creature of Rome in the first place. Now, these political and legal claims were not dishonorable. Again, for the same reason, they saw themselves as manifesting as much as possible the kingdom of God on earth, Europe always being the center of it. But since the papacy saw itself as a direct representative, not of the Apostle Peter, but of Christ himself, everything that implies, he's of course ranked much higher. It was Gregory VII, Pope Gregory VII, that attempted to eliminate German emperor's influence on clerical appointments. This was a matter of desperation for the Germans. As Henry IV grew, for example, he rebelled against this. So in 1075, he personally removed a Roman bishop, appointing another in his place, and then Pope Gregory ordered him to appear in Rome. And that's when Henry convened the Council of Worms, declaring Pope Gregory deposed. And it was a war of threats until Henry finally, in the pilgrimage to Canossa in 1077, that was a papal residence, fortress, begged to be received back. And he returned the imperial title to Henry. He took it away again anyway, later. Henry then eventually marches on Rome and occupies it and placed Clement III on the papal throne, who then crowned Henry. This, of course, as we all know, is the investiture controversy. It's one of the defining controversies in the creation and the consolidation of the German Empire. It's 1122, I think, that Henry V and Pope Callistus II came to an agreement. So, the papacy elected prelates, received clergy, and everything that implies. But secular rights still came from the emperor. But in practice, the emperor participated in the election of clergy. And the Concordat, from the Council of Worms, did not eliminate these contradictions. So while it created some kind of a compromise, it didn't satisfy anybody. Now, the upshot of all this is that this led to the secularization of the church, and because it's an imbalance, distorted European monarchies that resisted papal dominance. It was either the rule of the Pope or the rule of a quote-unquote absolutist monarch. But the word absolutism, we've defined this before on this show. Another element I want to bring up is that it means that he is independent of the church and, of course, its moral restrictions. This eventually ushered in the acceptance of Protestantism, not the creation of Protestant, but the acceptance of it. However, at its best, the Western order, especially in the German case, I don't want to talk about the Spanish because I'm no expert in that in particular at the time, but they had their own conception of symphony. Its estates and classes did attempt to serve the common good, the kingdom of heaven on earth as much as humanly possible, and it was disrupted by the investiture controversy. And things didn't get much better under Frederick I Barbarossa, elected emperor of the Holy Roman Emperor, and it's through him that the Holy Roman Emperor came into its own. And the Duke of Swabia, who was part of the Second Crusade, he was universally respected. He took part in the Third Crusade, and is really one of the standard bearers of medieval warfare. But just like under Frederick I, Barbarossa, and everyone else, these signs of feudal fragmentation that come directly from the confrontation with Rome arise, and they really never went away. After the death of Henry VI in 1197, another civil war took place, and this was ongoing. So Frederick II was forced to recognize the sovereign rights of both the secular and the ecclesial rulers within the borders of their own lands. And this is what led to the emergence of all of these small, independent principalities. And so despite the efforts of the Ottonians, etc., Germany again fell to pieces, despite them being Germans and recognizing themselves as Germans. Gregory VII is a key factor here. Gregory VII is one of the towering figures as far as the papacy is concerned. He is the first to lay out the utter supremacy of the Roman pontiff as vicars of Christ, not just vicars of Peter. And no council can bind him. Now, of course, the emperors never said that. And we're not going to get into all the arguments for and against. I'm exhausted with that stuff 20 years ago. And even there, I mean, the claim of being not just the successor of Roman power, but the successor of Christ himself had a laudable goal: the establishment of perfect justice on earth, which to them meant you had to have an indisputable papacy. But it changed everything. Because of the relative peace of the empire in the East, the church was preserved. Conciliar, equal local churches, and outside of the commonwealth, or outside of the empire, ethnic, as St. Photius would say, ethnic bodies creating their own churches. We can't get into the papal distortions of doctrine, but as the two sides of Europe fell apart, and the German emperor's relation to Byzantium was often positive, they had a lot of common enemies, and the papacy often being one, but not always. The Roman clergy wanted to replace state power, and they created their own parallel hierarchy, cardinals, legates, nuncios, etc. And so it became an army, so to speak. The church became a force in its own right. So, despite the appearance of preserving the church, it was a major failing. Now, of course, the Vatican, during this process, began to see orthodoxy more and more intensely as schismatic. The Crusades were allegedly aimed at assisting the empire, but whenever they liberated a city, they put their own bishops in there, rather than the previous occupants. I have a whole separate thing on 1204. I don't want to talk about that now. But that certainly, that's not necessarily a German matter. It was a matter between the Romans of the East and the papacy and the Italians. Again, I've done that elsewhere. Germany, however, and it's one of the things that formed Russian identity, was this onslaught, the Drang nach Osten, from the 8th through the 13th centuries, roughly. Attacks on the lands of the Western Slavs, which I mentioned already. And one of the great authors here is Barbarossa. And these were vaguely called the Northern of the Baltic Crusades, which certainly predate Barbarossa, but they were organized to displace very small tribes in the east. But they also ousted Russian merchants from places like Latvia. Slavic Baltic tribes in the area were Germanized, especially the Prussians. Another term for this is the Baltic Crusade from 1198 to 1411. Essentially, the knights of Germany, also the Danish and Swedish Catholic knights against pagans, the Finns like the Karelians and Estonians, the Slavs like the Pomeranians, the Balts like the Prussians. And it was to spread Christianity in its Western form. Pope Celestine III called the Northern Crusade to convert the Northern pagans. But they actively colonized every place that they conquered. Mecklenburg, Brandenburg, etc., as the lands of the Teutonic and Livonian knights. And these become extremely important. The new cities like Riga, Revel, Vyborg. Now, Lithuania was partially formed in its battle with the orders, Teutonic and otherwise. And to calling these wars a matter of crusades is iffy because they were called crusades only later. Not every military campaign in this regard was a crusade. And I don't have to tell you that, of course, they went after the Russians as well. And when the horde moved into Russia, the concern, especially of the northern Russian cities, was the knights, not the horde itself. It was Alexander Nevsky who scored great victories against the knights. And it entered Russian history as symbols of the confrontation between Russia and the West. Now, remember, you're not dealing with a unified Germany here. You're dealing with a highly decentralized set of orders. But it's true that as the Tartars, who I believe are Slavs, roughly 1237, 1240, 1245, roughly when Gregory the Ninth called for an actual crusade to subdue the Russian schismatics. And of course, St. Dmitry Alexandrovich, his victory over the Livonian Knights, etc. And it kind of came to an end in 1410. But it was Maximilian I who changed the name of the empire again to reflect the German nation. And I've never come across this anywhere else but in Germany. So it's not just the mission of the empire and the church, but German national identity as such. It is the height of stupidity to claim that there was no nationalism or ethnicity in the Middle Ages. It was dominant. It's just in how you define it. The unity of German-speaking lands, unity of Russian-speaking lands, were the dominant drive, especially in Germany, in the First Reich. I mean, even Louis the German, East Francia, united almost all lands that were inhabited by German speakers, almost. Same thing for Otto I. But of course, the battle, as I've said before, it's either, oligarchy or monarchy. And Germany, despite the commonalities amongst the entire, we call Germany today, which had far more in common than anything else, they defended their, what really was personal power, this patchwork. If you've ever seen a map of it, it's ridiculous. And this happens at the same time the papal throne is strengthening and strengthening. And so the Pope can play one side off against another. And of course, the Reformation made things worse. So the Roman Empire, the German nation, existed in a very loose, fragmented form, really until the beginning of the 19th century. And there you have, you know, Germany coming out of the Napoleonic War. But that's going too far afield. We started off by talking about Rome, whether it be the German version, Rome in Italy, Rome in Byzantium, and other variations. The goal was universal justice, essentially natural law. They don't believe all human beings are the same, but there are some general principles that unite all human beings, and I think that's undeniable, without going too far. But it wasn't just an external organization, but in the spiritual monastic truths as well. And Chalcedon said, you know, these are two different areas, but they are united through voluntary cooperation. Hence, free will is essential. Free will is found precisely in this balancing act. In the West, the balancing act fell apart. The East, with great struggle, and actually defeating the heresies had a lot to do with it, the Chalcedonian idea was maintained. We talk about all areas of life, education, economics, law, defense, diplomacy. The point was to make it easier to achieve the goal of eternal life. But at an absolute minimum, the emperor had to function as a restraining force. As I said before, the attempt to build a papal Rome led to them moving away from Orthodoxy. I don't even hold them morally responsible for this. It was an extremely difficult situation. But of course, the Second Rome came to an end. The Florentine Union was imposed on Constantinople in 1439, and it wasn't that long afterwards, 1453, that the Second Rome fell entirely. Keep in mind, though, that the Sultans also claimed to be successors of Rome. But the only real practical option then was Moscow. And this was approved by the Eastern Patriarchs as well, and designed for one purpose. All of these things that we're talking about have that one purpose in mind, whether distorted or not, and that's restraining the forces of Antichrist. Now, the Third Rome isn't a matter of national pride. It's nonsensical. But it's a crushing responsibility. But roughly during this period of time, you have the Ottoman Sultan claiming the Roman title, as did the Bulgarians in Trnava, and even for a short time, the princes of Tver. So as Byzantium fell, Russia remained really the only Orthodox people that had any association with it that were also not enslaved or about to be enslaved by the Turks at the very same time there was this liberation from the Tartar yoke. And that helped create an independent Russian state on more or less centralized lines, precisely as the Germans failed to do that. And again, the lack of balance, the lack of the Chalcedonian balance with the development of the papacy made that almost inevitable. The Bulgarians and the Serbs didn't have the size of the institutions to make it work. The reason that the Roman Empire of the West didn't survive Charlemagne for long was that the institutions weren't there. It was a personal union. Now, Russian rulers have long been related to the Byzantine emperors, all kinds of dynastic marriages, but the same thing goes for the Germans, starting with Saint Vladimir. I've talked about that many times before. Vladimir to Princess Anna, which is part of the baptism of Russia. Sophia Palaiologos, the niece of the last emperor, married Ivan III. And that raised the Russians to the status of universal empire. And this was pretty much self-evident, both inside and outside Russia. Any attempt to lure the Russians to union were prefaced by claiming that Russia is indeed the Third Rome. And even the promise of taking Constantinople as a legitimate heritage of the Russian monarchy. Even the Venetian Senate, I think I've said this before, the Venetian Senate actually said in 1473 that the Byzantine crown must pass to Moscow. Now, the concept of the empire, I don't care where it is, it has to have a certain level of centralization. The building of their own ethnic reality, not as a patchwork, like the German situation or the much later Habsburg situation in Vienna. And that implies, it's not just an administration, administrative matter, but it implies a religious awareness of the commonality of historical destiny. The fact that in Russia learned the Orthodox faith only indirectly from Byzantium. Directly, it was from the Bulgarians. I mean, the Patriarch of Constantinople was the head of the Russian church for a very long time. They themselves had overcome their princely fragmentation in the Kievan era. And it was the Tartar invasions. Again, Tartar is a non-ethnic marker. Doesn't refer to an ethnic group at all. Helped create this concept of cooperation amongst the princes that failed to cooperate during the initial invasion in the High Middle Ages. But all of that comes from the Orthodox political theory that comes from Byzantium, Bulgaria, and Serbia, and that contrasts to the Western rivalry between the church and the crown. But regardless, the bishops of the church, whether Germany or Russia, were central pillars to the centralization of the state. They weren't able to pull it off for a very long time, the Holy Roman Empire, but they did it in Russia. The horde, in other words, they contributed to the development of an actual Russian centralized ethnic empire, making Russia the successor of both the purity of the Orthodox faith and the Roman kingdom. We all know Elder Philotheus, who spoke to one of my favorite Russian monarchs, Basil III, and he says to him, "You are the only Christian king in the heavens. It is fitting for you to tremble with the fear of God. Fear God who gave you this dignity. Do not trust in gold, wealth, and glory, for all this is collected here and remains on earth here. Two Romes have fallen, but the third stands, and the fourth will not exist." I think most of you are well aware of this quotation. But it was the Second Rome itself, through intermediaries like the Serbs and especially the Bulgarians, that instilled that mentality in the Russians. Because they were part of its empire, part of its commonwealth. Several have said, and I like the idea of the Byzantine commonwealth. It was anointed, the one God for all Orthodox people. But not all Orthodox people are Roman. As I mentioned before, it didn't have to be specifically promulgated. The Third Rome was pretty much understood. I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago I talked about the symbolism of the double eagle. But they also imply, without actually saying so, all of the acceptance of Russia as the Third Rome implies that Charlemagne and his successors have no right to the title, especially taking it from the hands of the Pope. It's a usurpation of someone else's dignity. And it's true, you know, Charles did pursue marriage alliances with the Byzantine dynasties. He didn't, however, succeed in building the legal and even spiritual institutions for an ongoing empire. Both Byzantium and Russia had a rudimentary bureaucracy such that if a charismatic emperor dies, the system is going to fall to pieces. In Russia, and we're going to end here. This is going to be a part two next week. The contemporary literature here is extremely important. The Tale of the Council of Florence by Simeon of Suzdal. The Tale of the White Cowl, which is extremely important. The story of the capture of Constantinople, both of them from the second half of the 15th century. And the letter of Vassian, the Archbishop of Rostov, to Ivan III in 1480, focusing on the concept of the sanctified empire. These are extremely important, not to mention the elder Philotheus from the Pskov Monastery in Moscow, the Third Rome. And eventually they are repeated in things like the genealogy of the Russian Grand Dukes and the Book of Degrees in the 16th century. And the charter, interesting, on the establishment of the Russian Patriarchate. But it was the Patriarch Jeremiah who showed up in Russia to install the first Russian Patriarch and called Moscow the Third Rome. Yeah, the Second Rome was under the Turks, hoping, of course, for deliverance from this kind of oppression. So there was no doubt as to the Third Rome, its title and its meaning from the Second Rome. But it is important to note that the concept of the Third Rome here in Russia is even different than you found in Philotheus. In these stories, the Third Rome is an integral part of a total philosophy of history. So in the Tale of the White Cow, for example, the Patriarch of Constantinople sent the garment representing the guardianship of the church to the Archbishop of Novgorod because he had a dream that the Rus land was the Third Rome. And it's also removed from the apocalyptic context. The whole concept of the Fourth Rome is not to be. The impression here is not of impending doom, but of a bright future. This was a young, growing monarchy. In other words, Russia can take the finished and fully expressed Orthodox faith and the political vision and place them into action. So Russia embodied the ideal better and more thoroughly than any previous government. And Russia really didn't have a developed pre-Christian philosophy. That means that the Byzantine Bulgarian Orthodox tradition became the first comprehensive worldview that animated the state in all areas. So the Third Rome wasn't just the last, chronologically speaking, but it also became the highest stage of the improvement and the fullness of the expression of the notion of the universal empire. Well, I'm going to stop here. We're going to get into a part two next week. I'm going to bring all of this together in some kind of rational whole. But these are the things that built nations. These, in fact, were nations that built the religious history of Europe. And as I've said 100 times before, Germany and Russia are natural allies. And it was the perfidy of Britain in World War I that caused that to be violated. So I'll summarize this and finish this next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.